On Mass Street, Lawrence's main strip, the Free State Brewing Company is nearly full on a Wednesday night. The crowd is lively, the beer is abundant.
Wonderful beer selection, a thing for everybody, you know, from a light lager to a saison if you want to go that route. Good IPAs, stouts if that's your flavor.
Luke Otter is a bottle tech and brewer at Free State, and he's off the clock.
Right now I'm enjoying the Storm Chaser, which is our summer IPA with wheat malt to give it a little bit of sweetness.
The craft beer movement may be relatively new, but Free State has been around for quite a while. In fact, when it opened in 1989, it was the first legal brewery in Kansas since Prohibition.
The big draw of Free State, one alone, is the history behind it, and also our approachability, our hospitality. Craft beer now, it's about discovering something new and enjoying it. We care about who comes in here. It's very family-oriented. I mean, this company is a big family in the first place. It's one of the nicest things about this place.
Well, if it's a family, the brewery and restaurant's founder, Chuck Magrill, is the patriarch. He's something of a pioneer in the local craft beer and artisan food movement in the region, and a big part of Lawrence's story for the last generation. I'm Brian Ellison. Today, Chuck Magrill is sitting for one of our portrait sessions here on KCUR's Central Standard. Chuck, welcome to you.
Thanks, Brian. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
We are, too. I heard someone use that word pioneer to describe you. That's a word that has particular meaning in Kansas history, I suppose, imagining wagon trains and sort of breaking new ground and facing new challenges. Do you think that matches your life story here?
I think so. You know, we look at pioneers as people that go out and just find out what the next opportunity is and look for a new life. And I think that's an ideal all of us have in some way or another, that, yeah, let's see what we can do a little bit different today.
How did your family end up in this area in the first place?
A combination of Irish and Slavic immigrants. And, I mean, go back multiple generations. One of my great-great-grandfathers was a sheriff of Jackson County. Have a incredible letter to him from the governor of Missouri in 1869 offering reward for Jesse James and Frank James, dead or alive. And so, you know, that goes back a long ways. On my father's side, a Slavic from the Bohemian region of what's currently the Czech Republic. And, you know, he ran a fabulous little grocery store. He was a butcher and ran the grocery store from behind the butcher counter for 50 years down in what's now the Our Lady of Guadalupe region off of the boulevard down around 24th and Monitor.
Huh.
And that's kind of where I grew up, I guess, in a way. You know, I would spend my Saturdays at the grocery store bagging up and boxing up groceries and delivering them up and down the hills there on the west side.
Well, and that grocery background is going to come back to be useful to you as your life unfolds.
Food has always been a big part. And, you know, food as a part of the family celebration, as part of the, you know, what we share with each other on our, whether it's a celebration of the 4th of July holiday or whether it's maybe mourning people that have passed, but the food and beverage and the enjoyment that goes with that has always been a big part.
How important is that history to you? How much of your identity would you say comes from these people you came from and these places?
History has always been a big part for me. I mean, my mother was something that she was very deeply involved in. She just recently passed away. But history was a big part of her life as well and introduced that to me in a lot of ways. And in fact, with Free State Brewery, the thing that initially got me going on that was doing the research on history of brewing in Kansas and particularly the brewery that was in Lawrence in the 1880s. And, you know, I wrote a brief article about that in 1977, and that introduced the question to me of why we used to have 100 and some breweries in Kansas, and at that point we were at zero. So that history component was really the inspiration to try something new.
Mm-hmm. What did you want to be when you grew up? I imagine it wasn't a brewer.
I think early on it was, you know, I had an incredible appreciation for healing and medicine, I guess I would say. I mean, one of my early...
Well, maybe that is related to being a brewer.
I think in many ways I still accept that. Yes, indeed. One of my early heroes was a fellow from the Alsace region. It's currently France, but I think when he was born it was Germany. The Alsace region, a fellow named Albert Schweitzer, who mm-hmm. was just this mythical humanitarian and physician and created all sorts of benefits to humanity. And I saw that as being something that I could emulate and try to follow along with. I got distracted in the course of that. I started at the University of Kansas in biology and pre-med, and within a few years, food became the calling again, and I transitioned out of KU.
What were those college years for you in Lawrence like initially?
It's amazing, the early 70s, mid-70s in Lawrence, a very vibrant time. And there was a lot of uncertainty as to which way the country was going to go, a lot of political turmoil. Lawrence was certainly at the heart of a lot of that in our region. And so everybody, I kind of jokingly let people know that Lawrence as a community was founded by a bunch of New England abolitionists. Lawrence was one of those rare places in the U.S. that was not founded for an economic reason. It was not a crossroad. It was not a river port. It was not a marketplace. It was founded as a political cause. And as a result, there's never been a shortage of political causes to be found in the community of
you
Lawrence.
You feel like that's gotten passed down through the generations.
I think there's still some spirit of that permeates the community.
Yeah. So you before going to college, had been working as a kid in your family's grocery store. You get to Lawrence, and it sounds like it wasn't long before you wanted to be doing that work again.
It's true. Started early on with the founding of an institution, I'll call it at this point, that still is a main part of Lawrence, the Community Mercantile, which was a natural foods grocery co-op. And it was founded in the mid-70s. And I think really
And today we know that as the Merck.
The Merck,
but
correct.
But you were part of its founding.
Correct, yeah. And so I think part of it for me was the fact that, yes, I had a chance to run in and out of the back rooms at my grandfather's store. I was able to look in the meat case and see what were exotic items to me at that point, pig's feet and oxtail and snout and liver and things of that sort that my grandfather was putting out for sale. And being able to be in the back room of a business somewhat demystified it. It gave me the sense of how people provided that for their customers. And that, I think that's a really important part in anybody's life. It's once you see the back room and you understand how that works, it gives you the ability to say, yes, I can give that a go.
Demystified it, but didn't take the fun out of it, apparently.
Not at all, because you're still really at the core serving people. Hmm. And, like I said earlier, food is such an integral part of celebration and recognizing the humanity that we all share.
Did you talk to your grandfather or your parents as you were undertaking that new project?
Certainly. my grandfather was, somewhat skeptical. It's like, this is a co-op. This is, why aren't you just joining AG, Associated Grocers? Mm-hmm. And, he was certainly providing.
Because they would just bring you the food you needed. You would sell it. It would not be so hard.
Exactly. You don't have to think. You can just go ahead and open up every day, and there you go. But at the same time, I think there was also a certain sense of pride that yeah, there's a continuation of some of the activity within the family, and I mean that's gone on both sides of the family. From my mother's side, I've got a great ledger book from 1909 when my great grandfather ran a saloon, the Doherty and Wilson Saloon, and so I've got his ledger book from the Pabst Brewing Company. Logging each barrel of beer that he was buying for $7 in 1909.
And wow.
It's a fun legacy to be able to draw on.
So when you opened up the Merck, was there anything else like that going on in Lawrence?
Not really. That's one of the things that's extraordinarily different in our world today is Mainstream was the word of the 70s. And, you know, both in the beer business and in the food business, the variety was dwindling. And with the grocery business, it was really consolidating and uniform in some ways, kind of like you refer to with, you know, hey, everything you need is just delivered on the truck, so just put it on the shelf and don't ask questions. Well, you know, that's extraordinarily different these days with the amount of niche marketing that there is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our lives are so much enhanced now in comparison with what our options were then, and that certainly comes through in beer as well. I mean, the 1970s were seen as pretty much the low point in terms of beer variety and quality in the U.S., and there weren't very many breweries.
Well, and part of why there weren't many breweries had to do with the laws of Kansas, which we want to talk about a little bit later here in the show. But help take us back to that moment in sort of the 70s and the early 80s in Lawrence. What was the atmosphere in terms of entertainment, in terms of people being able to go out and have a nice dinner, go out and have a fun drink?
Well, entertainment was certainly mainly in regards to music, and there was a great music scene in Lawrence, continues to be. But there was a very serious restriction when it comes to going out and having dinner and having a beer or having wine, and that being that at that point Kansas was deep in the clutches of the private club approach to beer and wine.
Now, folks who grew up there maybe understand this, but I think a lot of us who've moved here more recently than that don't understand. What was the private club scene? I don't understand.
You know, it came out of the history of prohibition in the state and the attempt to continue to restrict people's access to beverage. And it said that you couldn't just walk into a restaurant, sit down and order a meal and have a beer or have a glass of wine with it. In order to have a beer or a glass of wine, you had to be a member of a private club at that restaurant. And that's what really had made such an amazing distinction in the Casey metro area, particularly. All of the good restaurants were on the Missouri side of the line. And so the Kansas side of the line really suffered that up into, you know, the late 80s because of this private club restriction, this notion that, yes, you had to have bought a membership and paid to become a private member of a drink consortium at a restaurant. It's just it's hard to imagine anymore.
How long were you involved in the Merck?
I was involved in management at the Merck for probably about 10 years or just a little beyond that, and then returned there for a short while back when I had gone back into the university again. I then went back to study water resource management in civil engineering at the University of Kansas. So water resources, biology, medicine, I think those all combine into beer.
Well, yeah, it is interesting. I mean, you are known for all of these entrepreneurial undertakings, but you actually have an academic side that is much more cerebral, it seems.
I always enjoy learning. You know, that's one of the things that I think is just so exciting about being alive. At one point, I had a friend of mine who had, you know, saying, "Hey, I've got an extra dictionary. Do you want it?" And I said, "No, I don't need another dictionary." And her rebuke was, "What? You already know all the words you need?" And I just thought that was a great response. It's like if you're not constantly learning and you're not constantly expanding your awareness, then it's time to check out.
The Merck was pretty unique when it opened. Nowadays, you do have other places that sell specialty food or organic food, but it has stuck around.
Indeed. And I mean, I think a lot of it's kind of interesting that one of the words that's been dropped from the name is the community Merck, but that is still a big part of what is identified there as a co-op, as a member-owned entity. It's a pretty unique operation. And actually, at one point early on, the head of the Chamber of Commerce in Lawrence had identified the community mercantile as being the sole economic deviant. And I love that line, the sole economic deviant in Lawrence. Something about an economic deviant just seems humorous.
Well, and speaking of deviant, you were not exactly satisfied with the state of alcohol laws and regulations in Kansas either, from what I understand.
Well, it really did seem like, so Kansas had that prohibition aspect, and I understand the motivation for it. There were some problems, but I think the solution that was arrived at, that prohibition idea, was not addressing it from the same angle I'd like to see.
Well, let's find out more about why Chuck wasn't content to let things stay that way. We'll pause for a moment in our conversation with Chuck Magrill, and when we come back, we'll find out what he did to overcome a century of legal barriers and start something truly new on Mass Street. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. KCUR's Central Standard returns in just a moment. Don't go away. It's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, and Chuck Magrill is here for our portrait session on this Friday morning. We've been talking about his life and the life of the state of Kansas leading up to 1989, when he opened the Free State Brewing Company, the first business of its kind in the state after Prohibition. We were just starting to talk a little bit about those laws and about the impact of Prohibition on Kansas. Kansas has a special relationship with the nation's history of Prohibition, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. But Brian, allow me for just
yes. I don't want to keep you from the important business of the moment.
Let's grab a quick beer while we're having this discussion.
by all means, I will. Everyone's welcome to partake of whatever they're most comfortable with here in our studio. What are you drinking today?
Right now, I'm pouring one of our great beers, our Dirty Kanza Kolsch. And this is a seasonal beer that we brew in celebration of an event that happens in Emporia, Kansas. It's just one of the most amazing events. It's a endurance bicycle ride, 200 miles of dirt and gravel through the Flint Hills. And so we brew a special beer just for that event and sell it around the region.
A Kolsch being a good, refreshing summer-type beer.
Beautiful for the 4th of July weekend. So allow me to just have a sip and we'll follow
through. Take as long as you need. We can wait. It looks delicious.
So Prohibition.
But you couldn't have done that in Kansas before a certain point. Even in the 80s, you couldn't have made your own beer in Kansas.
That's right. Kansas was the first state to enact a constitutional prohibition in the 1880s. And, that really did some serious damage to the brewing industry in the state. There were a lot of breweries in Kansas at that point, because of the German immigrant population, by and large. The Germans felt that a brewery was a crucial part of a community and of a society, and so there were plenty of breweries around.
I think people don't realize that in the 1880s that there was this incredibly diverse and rich beer-making industry.
Including in Kansas. Really the 1880s is also when we started to see the dominance of an Anheuser-Busch, for instance, and we started to see a few nationals come into play. But it was still a very local scene at that point. The change of laws in Kansas devastated the brewing industry. It was something that some of them continued to operate for up to 20 years, particularly up in Leavenworth and areas like that. And there were certainly legal challenges. And the very last brewery that actually existed in Kansas before we opened was in a small monastery out in Munger, Kansas, out near Hayes. And the Capuchin monks out there had a brewery in their monastery that they continued to brew beer in. And
religious freedom, as it were.
Well, the value of it, we've enjoyed one of the quotes from the diary of Brother Epp that just said, why do we go through all this effort in Kansas? Well, because without beer, things do not seem to go as well. And so having that that stamp of approval coming from the monks in Munger was a fun aspect. But
it's interesting, all those laws. Kansas was seen as fairly progressive, frankly, in its desire to implement prohibition in a way that I don't think we would understand today.
You're absolutely correct. Kansas had an extraordinary progressive history early on in its founding, and that both the aspect of the anti-slavery component of its founding as a state, a lot of the public education advances that have come through the state of Kansas, and prohibition was seen as being progressive at that point because there were plenty of situations where families were being devastated, where the adult, the husband, was perhaps drinking the family's fortune away and leaving his wife and kids destitute. unfortunately, rather than modify the divorce laws that would allow a remedy in a situation like that, the approach was taken, well, let's outlaw alcohol. And that has never really proven to be a very satisfactory route for most societies.
And, of course, it didn't work so well on a federal level either when it was tried.
Indeed. But Kansas then even, you know, held staunch in that, you know, so federal level, we repealed it in 33. Kansas, it wasn't until 1948 that Kansas began to modify that staunch prohibition aspect, and it's been a slow process ever since. And it wasn't then until the mid-'80s that a lot of additional changes came into play.
And what were some of those changes? What were the laws that kept there from being a brewery before the mid-'80s?
Well, I mean, as we spoke about earlier, one of the key changes that came into play in that time frame, basically we overhauled the entire code of alcohol law in Kansas in the mid-'80s. And one of the big things that most people recognize is the fact that you don't have to be a private club member to go in and sit down and get a slice of pizza and a beer anymore. And, you know, the other components changed nuances of the law. And I realized at that point, I'd been thinking about this brewery process and studying some of them on the West Coast that had just opened up. And I realized that I was going to try to change the laws in Kansas, it would be wise to go ahead and get in with this bigger effort and insert a few key provisions. And that's exactly how I approached the legislature. And it came down to the very last days of the session, but we finally got that in the law.
And what year was that?
Oh, goodness. That's I'm going to say probably 85, 86, somewhere right in there.
What was that like? So far you've told us you grew up, you know, working in a grocery store. You started the Merck. You've taken some classes on water resource management. You were not a lobbyist, and yet there you were in Topeka.
Well, the reality for Kansans is that it is still a very citizen legislature, and it is accessible. And I think it still continues to this day. You know, you can actually walk into the State House in Topeka, and you can see the governor walking the hallways. You can stop and interact with, you know, with the senators and representatives. We do have access to government that way that is not common in a you know, populous area like California, for
sure.
Instance. And so it is possible to have an impact, and it's good to be a little bit naive and not realize you can't do something and that can keep you going.
So that's what you did. You went and you just started talking to legislators. What were these conversations like? Was there pushback?
It was difficult in the sense that there were no models to show people. I couldn't just say, okay, well, you know, look, if you go to Des Moines, Iowa, you're going to see something like this. There was no real comparable. And so talking about breweries, really the only thing that people had as reference was, oh, I've been to that one in Golden, Colorado, or I've been
right.
to that one in St. Louis.
That one, yes.
And so that was that frame of reference. And so to be able to explain that that's not really what we're talking about in this, it's a you know, more local community really anchored in the immediate community. And there was pushback. I mean, there was pushback from different components. There were and continue to be prohibition forces associated with the state of Kansas and lobbyists that, advocate that aspect. And
on what basis? I mean, it's a very different culture by the 1980s than in the 1880s.
To some extent. But, Kansas was also liberalizing some of the gambling laws and the lotteries and things like that were always seen as vices. And so organizations like Kansans for Life at its Best, Reverend Richard Taylor, were really opposed to anything that would be seen as taking people's attention away from purity and that idea of social purity, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know.
And a slippery slope. I mean, sure, it's just beer now, but who knows what's next.
Indeed. And, you know, there were I actually received several – hate letters when I got a little bit of attention in the news that I was trying to start a brewery, and I was getting letters from anonymous letters telling me I was doomed to life in hell and fire and brimstone for bringing the demon alcohol to more people. And it's a curious target to have.
You know, we had a show a few weeks ago about liquor licensing laws in Kansas City, and even now I'm struck by how emotional and intense the conversation is when it comes to talking about drinking.
Well, I think tragically, I think a lot of people have immediate personal interactions. I mean, you know, I've had members of my family, you know, extended family, that have died as a result of you know, drunk driving situations. Everybody's seen somebody that's seen their life spiral downward as a result of their abuse issues. So there are aspects there that do have very, very important emotional responses. At the same time, I truly believe that a modest and moderate amount of alcohol consumption is a key to enjoying life and sharing that enjoyment with other people. I think that's the main aspect, that social aspect of sharing that with other people. I mean, I think in some ways, you know, one of the best phrases I could imagine is, you know, greeting somebody with, you know, good to see you, can I get you a beer? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what a welcoming sense that is.
So you are part of changing the laws that make it possible for something like the Free State Brewing Company to open in the late 1980s. And yet there's another barrier, which is simply Lawrence itself. It was a very different place than the one we know today, especially there at the north end of Mass Street.
It's really true. I mean, and so, you know, it's great to have Google Maps available these days, where you can just pretty much go any place in the country or even the world and see the cityscape. I sure wish there was a time travel aspect of that that somebody could put together, where you could go back and say, oh, this is what this block looked like in 1971. This is what it looked like in 1982.
What would they have seen where your brewing company stands now?
What they would have seen at that point would have been a bus depot. That was the Greyhound and Continental bus depot. Prior to that, it was the interurban electric trolley. It was a interurban public transit system that ran between Lawrence and Kansas City, and the trolley operated there out from right about 100 years ago. 1916 was when it started operating from there, and then the buses took over in the 30s, and up into the 70s and early 80s, and then it was an abandoned structure. I mean, it was nothing but a barn, and large portions of it were deteriorating and falling down. I mean, quite frankly, it was a, you know, kind of an overnight camp for homeless folks. And the rest of the 600 block was generally abandoned and dilapidated. There was a amazing, you know, just on the north end of the block was an amazing silver grain elevator, no longer used for storage of grain, but still, you know, just, yeah, this is you know, metallic grain elevator on the north end of downtown.
It doesn't seem like the most fertile territory for a successful restaurant and brewery business.
Well, you know, the whole aspect that we looked at was we were located just to the north of this revived theater called Liberty Hall. And the Liberty Hall project was an attempt to continue to keep this community gathering point and, you know, an area for speakers, an area for musicians, an area for theater, and to keep that alive. And so basically coming up against Liberty Hall, we kind of helped buttress that operation and took what was otherwise a neglected block of downtown Lawrence and saw a revival associated with that.
Were you successful right away?
Well, we were successful in the sense that we had people coming in the door right away, just curiosity. And at the same time, I remember by December of 1989, things had started to slow down. And I had this incredible sinking feeling of that was it. There was one little flash and it's over. And now that's all is left is bank loans to pay off.
Right.
And so, no, I would say there have been plenty of challenges over the years.
Opening a restaurant, not for the faint of heart in any, even the best cases, right?
It's easy to do because there's lots of people that will encourage you to do it. It's hard to sustain.
Yeah. We're talking with Chuck Magrell, who founded the Free State Brewing Company, which is a brewery and a restaurant. Your own interest in food, we've talked up until this point, has been in the grocery end of things. Where did you get interested in making food and selling food in the restaurant setting?
Well, it really came from a friend of mine, a guy named Tom Leonard that I had known for years. And, you know, when I was first thinking about the brewing end, I was probably more stuck in the manufacturing facet of it. But Tom was writing for a national magazine, and I just ran into him on the street in Lawrence, and he had just come from a small place in Yakima, Washington, and he just said, you know, you ought to think about this. There's this pub up there This guy named Bert Grant has just opened a pub, and he's brewing beer and selling it at the same location. And that's not something that anybody's been doing. And Tom's discussion of that and recollection of what he saw in Yakima prompted me to think, yeah, that idea of being able to make the beer and immediately turn around and sell it to your consumer eliminates this whole series of test groups and consumer surveys. You immediately see, do people like this, or what resonates with them? What's the enjoyment level? Where could we do better?
Well, it's also a taste of beer that most Americans at that point are not familiar with, one that's been brewed right there recently, not brought to you in a can through trucks over many weeks or months.
The fresh factor is incredible, without a doubt. And I mean, that's one of the things that is really important in beer. It's a perishable product. It's a live product. And, you know, it's just a part of fermentation. There are so many parts of fermentation that have an impact on our lives: bread, food, beer, yogurt, sauerkraut, cheese, just the list goes on and on. Beer is a fun part of fermentation.
Well, how did you first get interested in beer? I mean, apart from your genetics, apparently.
Well, I think perhaps that is part of it as well. Just that, with family gatherings every Sunday, the adults were always drinking beer. The kids, we had our bottles of soda pop, but beer was part of the family gathering, and so I do see that as continuing to be part of the social fabric. But from my perspective, there was also the interest in the biology of it. You know, mm-hmm. The science aspect of it is extraordinary and continues to be. The research that continues to go on having to do with the components of hop characters, the aspects of malting barley and the constituents of that, it's an ever-evolving process.
You mentioned that you wrote an article about the last brewery before Prohibition. What did you learn in that research?
Well, that was a fellow named John Walruff, and he battled the Prohibition forces. After Prohibition was in effect in Lawrence and in Kansas, he closed the brewery down in Lawrence for several months to reformulate, and then he came out with a new product that was called a Celebrated Stomach Invigorator, and it was you were advised to take the bottle and keep it chilled and then have one glass before dinner and one glass before retiring at bed, and you had to go to the local pharmacy to buy it. I mean, it's, I suppose, in some ways not unlike some other pharmaceutical items around the country these days. But, mm-hmm. There was that attempt to continue to operate the brewery under the restrictions that came into play. We once had a chance to go down in the caverns that still exist under that brewery. It was an extraordinary visit. My head brewer, Steve Brott, and chef Rick Martin and I had the subterranean experience of going through those caverns.
And so a lot of people are interested in the history without actually daring to undertake it themselves. Even if they understand the biology, that doesn't make them good at it. How did you become an actual real-life brewer?
Certainly with doing some home brewing, but beyond that, taking some classes out at UC Davis in California. I mean, UC Davis is kind of the ag school of the California system and certainly heavily involved in wine. And yet during the 1980s, they developed a brewing program that has continued to excel and become first class in the U.S. And, you know, being able to utilize those resources, ask people questions, it was a very small community of brewers at that point in the U.S. And so it was easy to walk into somebody's business and probe and gain knowledge.
And they were okay because there wasn't this fear of competition because hardly anyone was doing this.
Yeah, when I was talking to the Widmer brothers in Portland, Oregon, and they were like, we've heard of Kansas. But yeah, there was no sense that any question I was going to pose was going to have any impact on them other than, curiously enough, we are now brewing with the brew house from the Widmer brothers in Portland, Oregon, many, many years later. That's what we've used for our equipment.
I was in Portland last week and had one of their Hefeweizens, actually.
All right.
So you look at Lawrence today and even all the way across the Kansas City area, and it would appear that maybe you started something by doing this in the late 80s. Is that your read on it?
You know, it's amazing. We've kind of gone through a couple of different cycles of booms in brewing. There was a round of it in the mid-90s and now certainly exceeding that right now. And it's fun to know that there are people that have that great a fascination and an enjoyment that comes out of it. You know, the variety is extraordinary. I mean, we're well over 4,000 breweries in the U.S. right now, and it's definitely something that people have realized. We're never going to go back to a monoculture of you know, simple lagers. It's the variety that's there is just too great now to turn our backs on.
Has the business changed since your pioneering days in the business? I mean, does it require different skills and a different set of knowledge than when you first opened it?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, the expectation of quality is so much more enhanced. I mean, early on in the you know, the craft brewing days, many of the flavors that were identified, we now recognize as off flavors. And, you know, people would kind of humorously say, oh, yeah, I know exactly where that beer came from because of that particular defect.
Huh.
But it was a selling point. I mean, actually, that's not uncommon. You know, there's a green bottled beer out of the Netherlands that has a skunky character to it, for instance, and that's their distinctive flavor. And people identify that as such. But, you know, we've got much more sophistication, much greater appreciation for flavor and nuance now.
It strikes me that the novelty of it was a selling point early on, and it's just not novel anymore.
You're right. I mean, there's a discerning element in terms of people's appreciation. I mean, the amazing array of people that can talk about the nuances within different sour beers, for instance, unheard of 10 years ago.
So do you still feel like a pioneer in this movement, in this industry?
I still do, in the sense that I'm involved every day. I haven't retired from this business, and I'm constantly learning. I'm reading technical bulletins. I'm reading information from all over the world having to do with beer and barley, and it engages me every day.
Well, KCUR's Central Standard needs to take one more break. We'll continue talking with Chuck Magrill and get his take on what came next. He entered the field of bakeries. And what lies ahead? If you know Free State Brewing Company or Wheatfields, or want to add your own take on what Chuck has contributed to life in the Metro, call us at 816-235-2888. 235-2888. I'm Brian Ellison. Don't go away. Welcome back. We're getting to know Chuck Magrill today on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Chuck founded the Free State Brewing Company, but also, a few years later, collaborated to do the next thing. Chuck, tell me about Wheatfields.
Wheatfields Bakery is a great artisan bread and cafe operation that we have in downtown Lawrence. And I'd previously mentioned one of my friends, Tom Leonard, as providing information about Yakima, Washington for mm-hmm. the brewery. Tom also was very involved in, I'll call it artisan grains. He ran an operation called this Grain Exchange, which explored a lot of heirloom grains, having spelt and emmer and things of that sort. I had a small bakery in Salina, Kansas, realized that maybe that wasn't the best location for that effort and wanted to open a bakery in Lawrence. So, you know, I collaborated with Tom and with Chef Charlie Rascal, and we opened Wheatfields Bakery and Cafe.
Running a bakery seems like a very different set of skills and interests than a brewery and a restaurant. Am I right about that?
There are different requirements, without a doubt. I mean, we're using a lot of the same ingredients. The fermentation process has a lot of analogies. At the same time, you know, if we don't sell a beer today, we can sell it next week. A loaf of bread just doesn't have that same staying power, yeah.
and so do you find that work more challenging, more interesting, or how does it compare to what you do over at Free State?
You know, I said it's the same part of fermentation, but it's not in the sense that most people don't have that same immediate celebratory aspect having to do with bread. I kind of use a sauerkraut example as well. I think sauerkraut is great. For the last 40 years, I've been telling people sauerkraut's the health food of the coming decade, and one of these years it's going to be true. But I don't think we'd get as much acclaim if we opened a wonderful sit-down sauerkraut place, you know?
Well, I don't know.
Beer holds its own deal. But
you'd probably but at bread, least want to still have the beer, I'd say.
Sure, but bread is amazing. I mean, the transformation that happens with getting a golden crust on a beautiful baguette is just extraordinary.
Well, let's take a call or two here. Let's talk to Pat in Gardner. Pat, welcome to Central Standard. Pat, are you with us? We're not able to hear Pat, so we're gonna try to get that figured out. Anyway, let me ask you, Chuck, as you sort of look at what the restaurant and brewery culture has become in the Kansas City metro area, how would you assess it these days?
Well, again, we're seeing just extraordinary strides, and it's wonderful to see the variety that's out there. People are connecting with food and beer in ways that was just not imaginable 15, 20 years ago. So it's a very positive aspect from that end. And I think really I don't see any reason we're going to turn our back on it whatsoever.
Yeah. Since you opened Free State, obviously there's quite a lot more places that brew beer on site that have a wide selection of beers available. There's distilleries opening up all over, more wineries too. What do you think the connection is between those things and the community's identity? You mentioned earlier about the connection between consumption of alcohol and a sense of community.
Well, I think everybody wants to have a sense of pride of what makes their place unique and what can't be found all around the world. And so a lot of those things that you mentioned, the beer, the wine, the distilled spirits, do have a locale that people want to have some sense of pride in. And I think that's extraordinary. You know, we're continuing to see, we're actively involved in development of barley, malting barley in this region that hopefully within 15 years, I believe barley is going to be a big part of the component of the ag market in Kansas. And
because of this growth in places that sell drink.
I guess I should say also one of the components is probably some climate change that's also moving where different crops are being grown. But I think that's also a factor of saying, yeah, there are possibilities out in the world beyond what we've seen in the past.
Let's take a call now. I think we've got this figured out from Frank in Lawrence. Frank, good morning.
Good morning. Chuck, I want to talk to you. You might mention Carrie Nation, who was here in Kansas, Prohibitions, and also your open houses at your brewery, which I've been to. They're very fine out there in central part of Lawrence, where I've been. People come out there to see the brewery. You mentioned the Capuchin monks. There's this story about a monk coming through customs, and the guy pulls out a liquor bottle in his suitcase, and he says, "What's this?" And the monk says, "Oh, that's my Capuchin habit." Regarding
Frank, you're giving us a lot of things to talk about here. What you have
okay,
one
I'll
more?
I'll take the question off the air. The question is, I've been in the Free State Brewery a few times in the restaurant, but the noise level is extremely high. Any way you can deal with that? I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Well, Frank may just have to choose whether he wants loud noise or a lot of beer. They may go together.
Well, it's one of those things that we've certainly dealt with that question many, many times, and we've attempted some aspects of remediation, but it is true. We've got a stone building and concrete floors and boisterous people, and it at times it does make it difficult, particularly for larger groups, to carry on conversations. We try to have a couple of different segments within the business that we can accommodate that.
Frank did mention Carrie Nation. We were talking about Prohibition in Kansas specifically earlier. She's a Kansan.
Absolutely, from down in Medicine Lodge area. It's kind of curious. You know, Carrie, just to give a perspective on it, Kansas Prohibition, 1880, Carrie Nation came around about 20, 25 years later, so she was not part of the forefront, but she was kind of the follow-up second wave. And
she brought a certain vigor to the project.
She was a media specialist. Let's put it this way. Her activities in Kansas were about a six-month-long process. So in that six-month process, she developed such a national reputation that she hit the lecture circuits and did fairly well for the rest of her life.
We got Pat to call back here from Gardner, Kansas. Pat, thanks for calling again. How are you this morning?
I'm doing really well. I had a comment and then a question. The comment I have is going back to the 70s. I moved here in 1976 and talking about the whole thing with the clubs. But you also remember that crazy thing with the liquor cards where you had to have a card and to actually purchase the liquor in your drink. And then it never failed by the end of the night. Last call, and you wouldn't have enough money on your liquor card to buy the drink, so you'd have to buy another liquor card. And it was so annoying, and I was so glad when the law changed.
It sounds like these laws existed to just make it difficult for people to drink.
The question I have is that I remember after you opened, and my wife and I were out there, and we noticed everybody was walking around, and they had little snakes on their lapels. And we said, hey, what's up with the snakes on your lapel? And they said, oh, one of the owners the other night, he was out at the house, and he got bitten by a snake, and we're going to have this new ale called Copperhead Ale coming out. And I just wondered if that was a true story, that one of you did actually get bitten by a snake, and that's why you named it that.
Thanks for the question, Pat. Truth is what we're demanding now. Chuck, was there a real copperhead bite?
Absolutely true. No, it wasn't me, though. It was our head brewer, Steve Brott, and we actually had a new beer in the tank. We didn't have a name for it yet. It was a copper-colored beer. It had a good hop bite to it, and Steve was out one nice summer evening and walking from a friend's house to his pickup truck and managed to step on the wrong spot of the path. Ended up hospitalized with a copperhead bite, and all of a sudden we had a name for that beer that we didn't even realize at that moment. So
you've demonstrated a real entrepreneurial spirit in these various businesses. I'm wondering, do you still want to do other things? Are there things on your list that you have yet to check off?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I continue to have a variety of activities that I'm involved in and thoughts that are going on. And, you know, some of it has to do with food, barley project that I'm involved with. You know, I'd love to see some bison activity happening in eastern part of the state that I've been mulling over, and then other activities. I'm involved in a project at the Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, an open house, in an attempt to show, you know, kind of bridge some aspects of our communities and show the resilience of human spirit. So no shortage of ideas and opportunities to engage within the community.
Let's take one more call from Paul, who's also out in Lawrence. Paul, good morning.
Hi. One of my first things on my list when I go to England is to get a pint of bitter. I used to be able to find a beer imported from France here in Kansas that tasted like bitter, but it's not around anymore. Is there anything similar to that being brewed anywhere around?
Chuck?
You know, there are so many different breweries in the United States right now, and we've brewed several, at the pub, we've brewed several different versions of bitter that have actually won some very prestigious national awards. So we don't, part of our limitation is we can't have every beer all the time. You know, right now we have 17 beers on tap, which is extraordinary, but we do not have a bitter on tap. I'm glad he mentioned France, because I think a lot of people don't realize France has quite a brewing tradition as well, particularly that eastern area in the Alsace region. So beer is enjoyed in a lot of cultures around the world.
Is Paul, there a brand around anywhere?
You know, I couldn't tell you right off the top. You know, okay. Probably one of the best things I would say is you could go to some of the websites like Rate Beer or Untappd, for instance, and they could probably provide a selection of bitters.
Oh, okay.
Thanks, Paul, for the question. And one last question for you. If there's one beer of all the beers you make that captures who you are, what is it?
Oh, that's such a tough question. And it comes, you know, I guess I enjoy the seasonality of beer in the sense that, yes, I want to enjoy something different as time goes along. Probably if I was had to choose just one of our beers, it's going to be that Copperhead.
Chuck Magrell, Copperhead Ale and founder of Free State Brewing Company and other businesses in Lawrence. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Brian. I had a great time.
We had a great time, too. This portrait can be found online in Words, and we'll also have beautiful photographs by Paul Andrews. All of that, along with audio of today's show, will be online later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can find all our past shows there, too. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're @kcurcst, and I'm @ptsbrian. On Mondays this summer, KCUR is giving you a chance to enjoy some special programming at 10 a.m. and give us your feedback. On the 4th of July, we'll have an episode of The New Yorker Radio, so tune in for that. Central Standard will return on Tuesday. We'll check in with Worlds of Fun's most famous employee, at least among public radio listeners. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, and Fridays by Jen Chen. Our team also includes Suzanne Hogan and Andrea Tudhope, and our intern is Anna Sterla. Linda Scher is our announcer. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Gina Kaufman's on leave. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a safe and fun 4th of July, everyone. We'll see you next week.